case is Melvin Lane versus Crist Electrical Contractor et al., Ms. Mundy and Ms. Pollock. Ms. Mundy, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay. You may begin.
May it please the court, good morning. I'm Monica Mundy and I represent Melvin Lane. This workers' compensation case is making its second trip to this court, but unlike the last time, the procedural history of the case is not significant. This appeal focuses solely on the willful misconduct statute, and as the court can see from the full commission's last decision in this case, this is an issue that flummoxed them. And it is one that involves some very important issues as it relates to the Workers' Comp Act as a whole. We have raised a number of assignment of errors, but I believe that this case boils down to three essential issues, none of which is a pure question of fact. These all involve questions of law. First, whether Mr. Lane knew that this was a safety rule as opposed to a procedure. Second, whether the procedure applied to the work that he was performing at the time. And third, whether this constitutes a willful breach of a rule under the statute as opposed to a negligent one. Because all of these.
Can I ask you on that, Ms. Mundy?
Yes.
I hate to interrupt you so early in your argument, but there are a lot of questions here.
I would rather address the court's questions. There are a lot of ways to go.
How do you respond to the argument that a finding of willfulness, whether it's willful or not, or finding of negligence or not, is essentially a finding of fact? And therefore, given what the commission, the majority of the commission said, we have to show deference to that.
It is part of the statute itself. The meaning of willful and the determination of what constitutes willful misconduct or a willful breach of a safety rule has to inform itself from the statute. It has to, Your Honor. So it's not, and this court has said it, it is not a pure question of fact.
Mixed question.
It's going to be a mixed question. And what the statute means, which we have clearly placed at issue in the case, is a pure question of law. As it relates to the facts of this case, it's going to be a mixed question of law. And so the argument that this involves a pure question of fact on all counts is absolutely wrong. But let me start with the statute. Let me jump to the question of what this statute means. The statute requires a willful breach of a safety rule. We know the legislature picked these words with a specific intent in mind. Now, the Supreme Court recently acknowledged that the term willful is one that is very difficult, as evidenced by the three separate opinions in the commission below. But it depends upon its context for its meaning. And what we know as a fact is that this is a highly remedial act. It has a humane purpose. And the sole purpose of the Workers' Comp Act is to protect injured workers. Within that context, and knowing that negligence and even gross negligence plays no role in the act at all, we know that this word has a very special meaning. And what the Supreme Court said as far back as 1927 in the King versus Empire Colliers case is that it requires a wrongful intent. Now, with that in mind, I have a textual reading of the statute that I'm not going to address here. I'll rely on the brief for that. But I don't think that anyone can dispute that wrongful intent is an essential element of what is required to prove willful misconduct. And that's really what's missing here. And in the King case, the Supreme Court said that willful misconduct really, that all the elements of the willful misconduct statute involve the idea of moral blame, conduct that is quasi-criminal in nature, the intentional doing of something either with the knowledge that it will likely result in serious injury or with a wanton and reckless disregard of its probable consequences. None of them involve negligence, mere negligence. So with that backdrop, why is there not willful intent shown in this case? I'm sorry, wrongful intent shown in this case. The facts are undisputed that this was a safety-conscious employee. He was described by, I believe, everyone who testified in the case as very safety-conscious and, in fact, one of the safest guys on the team. Mr. Spruce, his supervisor, said he never thought that Mr. Lane would intentionally violate a safety rule. Now, in the prior performance, and the prior performance of the procedure was what I believe the majority of the commission relied very heavily on. Well, he had performed it. well, that, earlier that morning, and at least on one prior occasion before that. Why is that not enough? Because I think that really is part of the crux of the case. Why is the prior performance not enough to prove the wrongful intent? And here's why. Because on this record, with a safety-conscious employee, and with really the relatively lax training and orientation on this rule, in fact, the employer never really complied with its own rules regarding its training and enforcement of this rule. All it shows is that he knew how to perform a procedure. I'm going to talk about in a minute why we don't really think it's a safety rule at all, because it was a procedure. It's even described in the employer's own safety manual as a preferred method, a procedure, okay, which is really different from a safety rule, one that has the power to constitute a forfeiture of benefits for an otherwise injured worker in the course and scope of his employment. So under these facts, all that the prior performance shows is that he knew how to do it. It didn't show that he wrongfully intended to perform the act.
Let me stop you there. Faxton, the Supreme Court talked about the forbidden act. That he willfully, intentionally undertook to perform the forbidden act. Mm-hmm. What is the forbidden act in this case that he intentionally undertook to perform?
Correct. It's an act of omission rather than commission, which exactly. I want to talk about in a minute. It's the failure to lock out the overhead crane is what I believe that the employer was relying on.
But now, he didn't undertake at all to do that.
Correct.
So wouldn't the forbidden act be going up on the lift?
Correct.
Without having locked it out?
Correct. And there was no rule regarding that. And I believe that was admitted by the employer's representatives at the hearing. Now, there was isolated testimony from Mr. Spruce that said, oh, yeah, I told him that you could never use the scissor lift, which happened to be the one he was using that day when he was injured, as opposed to the boomer lift or cherry lift, which he was using earlier that morning. Oh, yeah, sure, I told him that he should never use the scissor lift while the crane isn't locked out. But the omission versus commission is significant. Because it's always going to be easier to prove wrongful intent when you have an act of commission, because the person is affirmatively performing the act. So that, I mean, that's more, it's going to be more proof. It's going to be easier to prove it. When you have an act of omission, the failure to do something, it's always going to be harder to prove. So the employers...
Is this a combination of the two, following up on Judge Petty's?
Yes.
That if you omit to lock it out, then the commission is when you climb up. And so therefore you've got a combination here
mm-hmm.
that he'd been instructed, you just can't do that, it's too dangerous.
Well, we have, and that, let me tie into something else too though, which is the ambiguous nature of the application of the rule. And that's one of our, and that is a more fact-based, I have to acknowledge, that is a more fact-based inquiry, and the commission's sole reason for saying that the rule applied to the work he was performing was because he had performed it earlier that day. And again, I go back to the position of, when you're talking about wrongful intent and the forfeiture of benefits, performing it earlier only shows that you knew how to perform it. It didn't prove the wrongful intent. But, The what he was told about the rule was, be careful of these hot rails. You know, you got these hot exposed rails. That's a danger of electrocution. Now, he was, you know, told don't work near the overhead cranes when they're operating. But this court has very readily, in a number of cases, looked extremely carefully about the application of the rule, because it's a fairness. It goes to your intent. If it's kind of not clear, I think the rule from this court is that if it is not perfectly clear that the rule applies, then you cannot apply the willful misconduct statute. And you've got the Owens-Brockway versus Easter case that we talked about at length. That involved a lockout-tagout procedure. I mean, it involved the same procedure here, which was written and which the employee knew about. But this court said, you know what? That rule didn't apply to the work that was being performed when the claimant went up and put his foot on the conveyor belt without locking it out. And the reason is because the rule as written, it was ambiguous as to when it applied. It really only applied when he was doing repair work, and this court said, well, he was only doing investigative work at the time to investigate why this conveyor belt wasn't running properly. Similarly, in Phipps versus Rand, This is the wet ramp case. This is where a guy who had to run boxes of stuff between this on this ramp to go to another facility, the employer said, don't use that ramp when it's wet. Well, then he and a coworker were instructed to put up a sign about the ramp, and they said, you know, caution, be careful when you use the ramp. Well, of course, he went on the ramp, he slipped and he fell and he was injured, and this court said, you know what, it was ambiguous. The instructions of the employer were ambiguous as to when it applied and held that the willful misconduct statute did not apply. And finally, in the Sproul case, which is an electrocution case, the employer had a rule about using rubberized gloves when working on live wire. And the claimant's state of mind in that case, it was both a state of mind case and an application case, this court said, you know what, the rule didn't even apply at that time because the claimant thought that the wire was dead, not live, and that's why he didn't use his rubber gloves. So the application of the rule is really very important. But also, and I can't dispute that the claimant knew, I think on this record and with the standard of review, I cannot dispute that the claimant knew that there was a lockout procedure. He did not know, however, that it was going to, that violation of that rule would result in discipline to him.
Was it his responsibility to lock this crane out, or was that the responsibility of one of the employees there?
That's a good question, Your Honor. And let me try to answer it this way. He was a helper. He was the lowest level of person with the least experience. The evidence was is that he had never really worked alone in the core cutter room laying the conduit except on this day of the accident. He always had someone with him. He was also required both by law, by OSHA law, and by the employer's own rules that he had to work under the supervision of an experienced electrician, specifically his foreman, Mr. Spruce. And as we pointed out in our brief, Mr. Spruce was off occupied by other things and not supervising him at the time. All the evidence was is that before the day of the accident, and I think this is undisputed, that he never really locked out a crane himself. He was either with a helper, a partner that he was working with, and they would do it together. And I believe that the record's going to show that he also, on the morning of the accident, locked out the crane with the crane operator himself.
Yeah, I thought Delta Star employees had some responsibility to actually perform the lockout.
They do, and Your Honor, they were the ones that had the locks. In fact, a week and a half before this incident occurred, Mr. Lane tried to, he wanted to work in a room, and one of the Delta Star employees had to show him where the locks were because his employer hadn't provided him the lock. And right, so it's ambiguous from his point of view, being only on the job for 4 months and only working in the core cutter room for a week and a half, it is ambiguous to him with a written rule that he's never seen and with the differing instructions that he was given by his employer, and with lack of really the adequate training that even his employer required, that he knowingly and willfully, wrongfully intended to violate this rule. It's just, this case does not rise to this particular level.
Okay. You're into your rebuttal.
Thank you. I'll reserve my time. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Roberta Ann Pollack, and I'm with Lucas and Kite representing the appellees in this matter, Crist Electrical and Ace Assurance Servants Corporation. We're coming at this case from the complete opposite perspective as the appellant, Mr. Lane. We believe this case is all about facts. It's about undisputed facts, it's about proven facts, and all the reasonable inferences deducible therefrom, and findings of fact which are binding on this commission, I'm sorry, binding on this court because they are supported by credible evidence. Those facts, when they are viewed in the light most favorable to Crist, as they must be, are that in the months preceding Mr. Lane's accident, in the week before preceding his accident, and on the very morning of his accident, Mr. Lane abided by each and every single step of Crist Electrical's lockout tagout rule. He went to the crane operator and he received permission to lock out and tag out the crane. He walked over to the electrical supply box, the power source. He pulled down the lever.
You're talking the morning of?
The morning of his accident,
but,
yes, Your Honor.
But let's focus on this concept of the forbidden act? Because that seems to me, anyway, to be one of the core issues here. What was the forbidden act that he intentionally did?
The forbidden act that Mr. Lane intentionally did was that he got into the scissor lift and ascended to the ceiling at the Delta Star plant without first having tagged out okay. The bridge crane.
There's certainly evidence that he intentionally got into the scissors lift.
Correct.
Doesn't there have to be some evidence that he intentionally failed to lock out the crane?
We believe there is evidence that he did, in fact, fail to lock out the crane.
But did he intentionally do it?
He has to
intentionally do the forbidden act.
Correct. In order to establish his willfulness, Mr. Lane has to have actual knowledge of the rule.
Okay.
And then with the knowledge of that rule, he has to undertake the forbidden act and do so intentionally.
Act is really getting up in the crane without having done something.
Correct.
So you can prove that he intentionally got up in the crane. Where does the evidence establish that he intentionally failed to lock it out?
That evidence comes in the fact that prior to his accident, Mr. Lane was told the rule by Mr. Spruce, his supervisor, by Dennis Branham, the lead electrician on this job, both of whom are employees of Crist Electrical, that both of those individuals explained the rule to him in detail. They took him on a tour of the Delta Star plant. They showed him the hot rails on the bridge crane. They explained to him the importance of never to work around that bridge crane without having locked it out and tagged it out. In fact, both of those individuals, as well as a Delta Star employee, David Wright, who's a crane operator, showed Mr. Lane.
But suppose he just forgot. My wife tells me it's always a good idea not to forget where you put your car keys, but I do it quite often.
Well, if he
forgets, I mean, that's not an intentional act, one done just forgetting to do something.
Correct, negligence as opposed to willful. In this case, the willfulness, as even indicated by I believe it's Commissioner Marshall in his dissent, willfulness is established by knowledge of the rule coupled with undertaking the forbidden act. And in this case, there can't be any doubt that Mr. Lane knew of and understood the rule. He'd been told it, he'd been shown it.
As pointed out, this is an issue of omission as opposed to commission.
Correct.
So how do you intentionally omit to do something? Well, where is the evidence, I guess, better put, that he intentionally omitted to do something?
The evidence is in the fact that he had done this before. It's the same bit of evidence, you know, the few undisputed facts that both sides are arguing from here, I believe. I don't think many of the evidence is undisputed.
You answer Ms. Mundy's argument, at least this is how I understood it, that yes, he did it that morning earlier.
Correct.
But he really hadn't done this very many times before. And that morning he was under someone else's supervision. Whereas when he didn't do it, he was not under supervision at the time.
We believe the record supports that he did, in fact, lock out the crane that morning on his own and had likewise locked out, tagged out the crane without supervision previously. There's testimony
even
in the record.
Before that day.
Correct. A week before. There's testimony in the record that he had come to the crane operators, I believe Michael Manning, or David Wright, and he did ask at one point, I believe it was Mr. Wright, please show me where the Delta Star lockout tagouts are. But he had previously been shown by Crist Electrical employees where Crist's lockout tags were. They were in a gang box, which was located in the core cutter room.
Counsel, where in the record is it clear that it's his responsibility alone to do that?
Mr. Lane's responsibility
right.
alone? I believe there's testimony from his supervisor.
The same supervisor that was responsible for overseeing him doing that?
Mr. Spruce, I believe, Buck Spruce, as well as Dennis Branham. He's the lead electrician on the job.
Okay.
I believe so, Your Honor. We would also assert that this is a factual matter entirely before the court, that statutory interpretation is not necessary.
So whether the Lockout-Taggart rule applied to what claimant was doing at the time of his accident is a question of fact.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me shift just a moment to the issue of whether there is a rule or safety procedure in the first instance. It was my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that this Lockout-Taggart procedure was actually a rule of Delta Star. Am I correct on that?
Did you say, I'm sorry, a rule of Delta Star?
Delta Stars. And it was kind of adopted by reference by Crist.
Delta Star did have a Lockout-Taggart procedure, but Crist Electrical had a safety procedural manual within that manual had a Lockout-Taggart procedure as well. And both Crist Electrical employees and Delta...
Wasn't Crist's policy a little more vague than Delta Star's was clear? But my understanding was Crist kind of adopted that rule by reference.
I believe there is a Lockout-Taggart procedure described in Crist Electrical's safety procedural manual, and
what's on Joint Appendix 133, 134? Is that what you're referring to? Or?
Let me look, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, I believe it's begins on 133. The Lockout-Taggart procedure for Crist Electrical Contractor. The appellant is saying, I believe their argument is that this was more of a procedure and not a rule. And there's case law that holds, you know, you don't have to call a rule, it can be referred to as a procedure. And as far as this Lockout, Taggart procedure and or rule applying to the work that Mr. Lane was doing on the day he was injured, it would not make any sense at all for Mr. Lane to have been repeatedly told and reminded about a rule that did not apply to the type of work he was doing, and it would also not make any sense for him to repeatedly comply with a rule that did not apply to the type of work he was doing. If this rule did not apply to the type of work Mr. Lane was doing, then it doesn't make sense that he would have been allowed to get into the scissor lift and go up to the ceiling without having locked out or tagged out the crane. He would have been injured, as he was in this case. This rule absolutely and positively applied to the work he was doing. I believe both Mr. Branham and Mr. Spruce both testified at the hearing that the rule applied to the type of work that was being performed.
In Thaxton, did the Supreme Court actually hold that a lapse of memory could form the basis of willful misconduct, is my memory of that wrong, or is it just dicta so it's not bonding, or what is it?
Your Honor, it's our position that language is purely dicta, and I believe Mr. Lane conceded in his brief as well that language is purely dicta. Negligence, no matter how gross, has never been a bar to workers' compensation. It's our position that language is pure dicta.
So really, that portion in Faxon does not help your client. Is that what you're saying?
I would say that it wouldn't help our client, but it doesn't, and I'm trying to find my, if I may, Your Honor, find my notes very quickly on Faxon.
That's all right. I mean,
that's okay. The facts of some of these cases were so similar, I continuously got them confused. That language, it would certainly not help our case. It would make it seem that negligence would be a bar to a workers' compensation case, which is never the facts, which has never been the case. And this opinion, the holding by the full commission in this case, didn't, as Mr. Lane asserts, didn't allow negligence to become a bar. All the commission held was that the employer is not required to prove an intent, that the employee didn't have the intent to do the act. All the employer is required to prove is that the employee, with the rule in mind, intentionally performed the forbidden act. It's our position that's what Mr. Lane did in this case. He knew the rule.
If you're aware of the rule and you just do the act, even if you're not thinking about the rule, that's willful misconduct.
Correct. That is what 90 years of case law has always held. If you know the rule, yet you intentionally do that forbidden act, you are guilty of willful misconduct. And whether or not you're guilty of willful misconduct is a finding of fact that's binding on this court. Yes, Your Honor.
Could an employer adopt a rule that says, don't do anything that might get you hurt? And then when the employee does something and gets hurt, say, well, you willfully engaged in the forbidden act.
I don't think that would insulate the employer from liability. You have to prove, because the employer has to prove that the employee knew the rule, knew of and understood the rule and the importance. That's broad. In this case, the rule was verbally told to Mr. Lane on multiple occasions. He was shown the rule. He was taken through the steps to do the lockout and tagout. He knew the rule. We don't think there can be any question of that. He did the act knowing what he did was wrong.
Again, the act he did wasn't what hurt him. It was the act he didn't do that hurt him.
That he didn't lock out the crane.
And it's that omission issue just doesn't seem to fit well with this language that we're dealing with about willfully doing the forbidden act.
That he intentionally did the forbidden act. Well, intent can be inferred from facts and circumstances. And that is what happened in this case, the facts and circumstances being.
Now, if there were facts and circumstances that said, look, I'm only going to be up there for a second, I don't need to lock it out, or, I haven't got time to do that, or something to show that he intentionally avoided doing something he was required to do, I'd find it, a little clearer. But just to surmise that because he didn't do it, he must have intentionally not done it is a stretch.
I think what's telling in this case is the fact that he had done all lockout tag out before, and on the very morning of this accident, just 3 hours after having locked out and tagged out, having gone through the entire procedure, Mr. Lane didn't go seek the permission of the crane operator. In fact, he walked over to the power switch on the door, which I believe the record said was located directly next to, within 5 feet of the scissor lift he was getting ready to go up into. And he didn't
so
power down.
So is your position that if there was not evidence of him having done it earlier that day, then it wouldn't be deemed willful?
I think it would still be. I think it strengthens our case that he complied with the rule earlier that morning. But we believe that his actions in knowing the rule yet not complying with them would still have made his acts and conduct.
So your position is still that if you know a rule and don't do it, you're willful, you've met the willful requirement.
If you know the rule and you intentionally perform the forbidden act, yes, Your Honor, that's our position. That's what the case law holds. The case law interpreting the willful misconduct statute has always held.
So if an employer enacts a rule that says don't work any closer than 2 feet from the edge, and somebody falls off the building, that would be willful misconduct.
Well, it would depend if they know the rule.
Yeah, if they know the rule.
Right.
I know the rule, don't work with, but that can't be because, somebody could trip and fall off the building. Or there could be a multitude of reasons you fall off the building besides being within 2 feet of the edge.
Right, you have to have the intent, the necessary intent to do the forbidden act.
But you want us to infer the necessary intent from the mere fact that the accident occurred.
Well, the commission found as a finding of fact that he did intend the act, and we believe that's a finding of fact that's binding on the court.
But only if there's something in the record to support that.
And Chris believes there is, his prior compliance, the fact that he
so
had done
the
acts.
So you're going back to the prior compliance?
Correct, Your Honor. Any further questions from the court?
How do you respond to Ms. Mundy's point with my first question to her about what's the standard here? I know you say everything's a finding of fact. She said the willful breach question has to be a mixed question because that's part of the language of the statute. And you just said that willful breach is a finding of fact. How do you respond to that?
Whether an employee is guilty of willful misconduct is a finding of fact. That's our position. That's what was found in this case. We would concede that if we were here on a purely statutory issue, that would be a de novo review, and it's our position that is what Mr. Lane would want, is a purely statutory interpretation issue.
I mean, the finding of willful misconduct, though, pretty much gets you to the final legal answer in the case, right?
I missed the last part.
If a finding of willful misconduct, which you said is a finding of fact.
Correct.
And which, if it is a finding of fact, we are essentially bound, if there's any evidence in the record to support it, according to case law. But isn't a finding of willful misconduct pretty close to the ultimate issue in this case, the ultimate legal question, too?
Ultimately, it is, Your Honor, which at best then would be a mixed question of law and fact and reviewable by this court.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Mundy, you have your 3 minutes of rebuttal remaining.
Ms. Mundy, can I ask you just from Thaxton, and you've alluded to this, but in Thaxton where they talk about, you know, the forgetting, and then the court says, it is not necessary for the employer to show that the employee having the rule in mind determined to break it. It is enough to show that knowing the rule, which clearly he knew the rule because he did it earlier that morning, he intentionally performed the forbidden act.
We agree with the employer that it's dicta, number one. Number two, it's inconsistent with a lot of other case law from the Supreme Court of Virginia, including the 1927 case of King. It is contrary to this court's case law, and it goes to the question.
And
this court can't reverse Thaxton, but it's dicta, and the employer has agreed with that. But also too, I think there's an important factual difference. And forgive me, because this is going to require some history about the willful misconduct statute. Back in the Doe's days, and up until somewhere in the 50s or 60s, that statute required that the rule be not only adopted by the employer, but approved by the commission. So there was a higher burden of the knowledge part. There was more formality that went with it. Second, and this goes to knowledge, the claimant was an electrician. And you're talking about an electrocution case. I mean, there is nothing more fundamental to an electrician than all of the rubber gloves cases and electrocution. You got to turn off the power source. It is fundamental and essential to the job. We don't have that in our case. It's not an electrocution case. So, as I said in the brief, I think a lot of the outcome in Thaxton was due to the sheer weight of the evidence of his knowledge of the rule and the formalities that went with sort of the adoption and approval of the rule. Now, we no longer have the rule that needs to be approved by the commission. But if anything, some of the case law that the employer relies upon demonstrates a lax enforcement of the core requirement that this be wrongful intent. And this goes, if I could turn then to the comment from Judge Petty, which was, it can't be this way. It cannot be this way that you can forfeit benefits based upon pure knowledge of the rule at some point and performance of the forbidden act at some point. You have to join the knowledge with the time that the act is performed in order to prove the wrongful intent. It has to be. It can't just be that at some point, because otherwise we allow negligence to come into the equation. And, you know, I'd thought of some things like Judge Petty did. You know, what about an employer who says, well, you know, you have to close out the lights inside and you have to turn on the lights outside in the parking lot before you leave the building, and you forget to turn on the lights in the parking lot and you fall. I mean, everything becomes a safety rule. Turn off the coffee maker, turn off the lights, you know. We all forget to turn off the lights in our car. We forget where our keys are. We do all, I've left the light on in my dressing room past couple nights. I forget to do it.
Consequences here are much greater than any of those examples you just mentioned.
True, and Your Honor, I don't believe that there's any evidence that anybody at Crist told Mr. Lane that if he failed to comply with the lockout rule, that he could be knocked off a crane and die. Instead, really what they were suggesting was, watch out for the hot rails. This is an electrocution problem.
Mr. Menegay, you've used up your rebuttal. Thank you very much for your argument. We will greet counsel, and our next